My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, I'm Essie Moadi, founding partner of Mighty Capital, and I'm excited to host this series on the age of product. Let's hear from my guest today.
All right. Hey, Spencer, welcome to the Coffin podcast, and please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Essie, it's fantastic to be here. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Spencer Skates. I'm founder, co-founder and CEO of Amplitude. Started Amplitude back in 2012, launched the company in 2014, along with my two co-founders, Curtis and Jeffrey. And today we are the leader in the digital optimization system and do product analytics. And so really excited to be here. For those of you who also don't know, we were the very first investment by Mighty Capital. And so it's awesome to have things come full circle and close the loop back with you again, SC.
Absolutely. And the rise of Amplitude has been so phenomenal. You turned it into a unicorn and beyond. But I want to start by going back to your early days. And maybe you can tell me and tell our listeners about your favorite venture investors, how you met them, how they earned your trust, what got them to stand out. And then, you know, if you go back to your younger self back then, what are the top three learnings you tell yourself as a younger entrepreneur?
Yeah, for sure. So for the record, because we're recording this, I want to make sure it's clear to everyone. My most favorite venture investor is my wife, Anne Lee. She's a consumer investor at Andreessen Horowitz. Just to make sure that I'm really clear with everyone about that.
That definitely makes it super compelling. Awesome.
Yeah. So it's been fantastic. She's been specialized in early stage consumer. In terms of investors in Amplitude, you know, in terms of folks who have put in money into the business, you know, if I had to, you know, have a lot of phenomenal folks supporting us, you know, the folks at Sequoia, GIC, IVP, Battery, Y Combinator did, you know, a lot of great folks. But if I had to just pick one, you know, I'd say no question in terms of folks who have been investors in Amplitude, that's Eric Vishria at Benchmark by far. He invested in us during our Series A and has been on the board and has been working with me for the last 7 years. And in terms of if I, you know, he's also this is not common for an investor, but he's also the person who's probably taught me the most about what it means to be a great CEO. You know, I've learned, you know, whether it's building a team, building a great company, you know, thinking about the strategic moves you need to make in the market. You know, he's been the person that I'll call the first on any sort of issues that I have. And so, you know, no question that Amplitude would not be even close to what it is today without the work that he's put into the business. He, just to give you the backstory of how we met him. So we were out raising our Series A in December of 2014. So this is way, way back. And had met a number of other investors, had gotten a bunch of offers to invest in Amplitude. We got four different offers from four different great VCs. And, you know, I kind of wrapping up my process and I had gotten connected with Eric and the team at Benchmark. And I actually didn't know the folks at Benchmark before. You know, I'd looked them up and, you know, they're kind of one of the more quieter investors in the Valley. But the successes they had were just insane. I mean, you know, you look at it, it's like Twitter, Uber, Snapchat, Zendesk, Yelp, you know, the list, Instagram, the list goes on and on and on. And so their track record is like, you know, had been one of the, just basically been the top in all of Silicon Valley. And so, you know, I didn't really know them. And so I, you know, all I had heard was that they're very selective and very picky. So I had kind of met them at the end of the process. And somehow Eric and I just clicked and hit it off. He had just started as an investor himself after winding down his previous company, Rockmelt. You know, we went through the process with them. They presented us an offer, and you know, I thought long and hard about what is it I'm trying to do with Amplitude. And what was really clear to me was like, hey, I want to build this business into the most biggest and most successful business possible, because I'm a big believer in the power of technology to make the world a better place for all of us. And the way to do that is by, you know, partnering with other people who have a track record of bringing companies to greatness. And so when it came down to it, even though I hadn't known them for that long and just met them through the process, it was kind of no question, hey, we got to work with Eric and the Benchmark team. And it's kind of delivered way, you know, they've delivered way beyond our kind of wildest expectations, you know, in terms of being a supporter and a coach and a mentor. And you know, almost like another co-founder in the business. So it's been phenomenal to work with Eric. You know, and he's like we would not be a fraction of the size without the stuff that he's done on Amplitude.
That sounds awesome. And I've met Eric a couple of times. I think the world of him. Tell us a little bit about how he earned your trust. Is there maybe one memory you can share of, wow, that was really awesome. I really want to work with this guy. And then share something that you've been doing since you met him, since he joined your board, that you think had a massive impact on the fate of Amplitude, so that we put that in picture.
Yeah, I mean, he opened up his network right away and helped us recruit so much of the early team. A huge number of our early engineers came from folks who had previously worked with him or overlapped with him. Some of our earliest executives came directly from his network and people he helped us recruit and refer. And so, you know, there's one point where like maybe a third of Amplitude in terms of employees were referrals from Eric. You know, most of the time you'd be lucky if you get, you know, one, maybe two good hires out of investor, but you know, there were, you know, probably, you know, over a dozen people that came directly from, you know, him and his network to Amplitude. You know, our first sales leader, our first design leader, our first CRO, you know, our first set of engineers on the front end team all came through Eric. And, you know, yeah, without all of those people, you know, we wouldn't have been able to build Amplitude, you know. So that was really big. He, you know, he's been helpful, incredibly helpful on every single round since, you know, from our Series B to the C, you know, to kind of onwards. He set it up and helped, you know, pump up later round investors into becoming investors into Amplitude, and we wouldn't have gotten those rounds done without him or Benchmark. And then the last piece of it, he's interviewed every single executive hire that I've ever made at the company, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. You know, as we've built out, you know, I've hired a lot of executives over the years and brought them in the business. And, you know, he's probably interviewed over, you know, definitely over 100 people at this point, you know, maybe a good deal more. And he's just always very insightful in terms of the match between the, you know, potential executive and what we need. The biggest challenge that you have as a first-time founder CEO is that you don't know what a great leader looks like, because this is your first time building a company. And so it's how are you able to evaluate what does a great sales leader look like, or what's a great engineering leader look like, what does a great marketing leader look like? And so I just learned a huge amount from that by working with him. I remember, you know, he's a marketing background. And so I was like, you know, I was like, hey, tell me about the difference between sales and marketing in the early days. So he's like, oh boy, you know, we really have to go through the basics here with Spencer. So, you know, getting expert, you know, help and coaching like that just can accelerate your learning versus having to figure it out yourself.
That sounds like an awesome partnership. And you're one of the extremely rare founders who, you know, even as a first-time founder, takes a company from like year zero to, you know, you guys are unicorn and likely on IPO track, it's a rare talent that you have. And it sounds like his support has really helped you grow at super high speed. If you were putting yourself back in the 2014 shoes, what are some of the advice you'd give your younger self when establishing a relationship with someone like Eric?
You know, we were very lucky with Eric. I think it's rare actually to find a Series A investor like that. So it's a lot of times with investors as CEO, you have to think about managing their psychology, you know, and making sure they don't get freaked out by the ups and downs of a business. But with Eric, it was always the other way around. He would, you know, help make the, you know, bring up the lows and make the highs, you know, more even, so that, you know, you weren't constantly being thrown around and freaking out. So I actually, you know, if you're lucky enough the advice I'd have, if you're lucky enough to get the opportunity to work with someone like that, is to take it. You know, that's the biggest by far. And you know, I think, you know, if I had to say the qualities that make that up, you know, I'd say there's kind of really three key qualities I look for in every board member. And really this started with Eric. Was the first is, like, do they have empathy with the founders? The first time founder journey is just one that's incredibly hard and so different from working, you know, in any other job. And so someone who has the empathy of the challenges is so important. Because they will know, you know, on that psychology piece, they will know how to help you manage that. I'd say the two other qualities are, the first one I'd say is, like, you know, do they work hard? You know, so there are people that will have empathy with founders, but, you know, you won't necessarily be able to get their time and their work and input into the, and their energy into the business. And then lastly, do they know what they know and know what they don't? You know, there's also a lot of VCs that can be, you know, they think themselves as the kingmakers. They have access to capital, and that means they believe they already know everything about how to build a business, when the truth is they don't. And so, you know, I remember having to argue with venture capitalists about the stupidest things on Amplitude, about our product, about our pricing, about, you know, all sorts of silly things where, you know, they were, you know, they had maybe read a blog post and felt like they were really smart and educated on topic, when the reality was that, you know, they actually didn't know as much as we did. So, you know, but there are a lot of things that they do know, that the right ones that will know, like, you know, how do you build out a great organization, or what does a great, you know, sales talent or engineering talent look like, you know, particularly at scale. So just to sum those up: one, deep empathy with founders; two, you know, willingness to work hard; and three, you know, knowing what they know and knowing what they don't know. The other thing I'd say about that is, you know, if I had to give myself one advice, it would be to hire experienced help earlier. We had always been behind at Amplitude at doing that, I'd say really up to the last year or so of the company. So from about 2015 to about 2020, we were behind the curve in hiring experienced, and it hurt us because we didn't have enough leaders who knew where different parts of the business were going so that they could build ahead of it. And so ended up running into a whole bunch of pain. So that would be the biggest, you know, piece of advice I'd give myself, is lean way more into that. You know, I think one of the problems with really smart engineers and really smart people is that they think, hey, you know, I figured out this engineering thing smarter than anyone else. I can figure out sales. I can figure out marketing. I can figure out finance. But the truth is, I mean, you can figure them out, but it'll take you a lot longer if you're trying to do it on your own versus learning from people and leaders who have done it before. And so that would be the biggest piece of advice I'd give myself, is just to focus more on bringing in experienced talent to complement the less experienced and raw talent and energy that we had at Amplitude.
Yeah. And I think it's a really hard balance, right? Because you're trying to disrupt, innovate, do things differently. And so you want to not take too many very experienced people, but at the same time, sometimes they help you accelerate. So it's definitely one of the maybe more difficult balance to strike. So I can see how that's a great insight that you're sharing. I want to jump now to today, right? We're emerging out of an insane pandemic. But with that pandemic came the acceleration of a lot of digital transformations. A lot of people say 2020 was a dog year, right? 7 years in one in terms of digital transformation. And what we're seeing at Mighty Capital, and I think you're seeing the same thing at Amplitude, is that we're getting into an era where the best product wins, right? Having a great product is actually a strategy to win against large players like the FANGs. And Amplitude has been at the forefront of that. So I'd love to hear from you how you've been sort of pioneering and now also architecting this revolution. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So when we founded Amplitude back in 2012, the thing that we saw was the very best product teams were taking a more quantitative approach to building product. And, you know, if you had looked at the Facebooks or the Netflixes, or the Amazons at the time, they had built out these massive data science and data engineering teams, and they were basically measuring all of what was going on in the product and using that to help them figure out what was working, what was not, and what they needed to build next. And we said, hey, everyone out there is going to need that infrastructure in order to be successful as a company. You know, it's we now have the luxury as developers of actually seeing how people use our products. You know, it wasn't always true. You kind of just ship software and that was it. You don't know, you have no idea how people use it. But now you can actually observe how it is people use the products, and that will allow you to innovate way, way, way faster than, you know, a team that doesn't take that approach. And, you know, that was why Facebook broke beyond the 100 million monthly active user marks and, you know, became the social network, and it kind of broken past its peers because they had taken this approach to building product. And so we said, okay, well, we know that to your point, SC, we're in a world where consumers have infinite choice. The best products win, right? You know, the app store websites, there's, you know, tens of millions of products on these things. And so you can easily, you're not locked into using one set of one product. You can easily, very easily switch your experience. If you don't like one media company, you can go to another. If you don't like one piece of, you know, let's say tooling software for your job, you can go to another one really easy. It's very easy to switch. And so because the switching and distribution costs have gone to zero, really, it's consumers getting to choose on the basis of which product experience they like, which is just a wonderful place for the world to be. And in order to win that, yeah, you need to make the best product experience. And so we said, okay, let's help everyone. Let's build the infrastructure behind that allows teams to do that. So that was part of the trend that we saw when we first started Amplitude, and we said, okay, you know, let's build a company behind it.
So tell us maybe a couple of stories. One is the story of Amplitude winning against Google Analytics. Maybe pick an example of a deal and how you having a better product was a win. And then maybe pick one of your customers and share a story of how them having a better product allowed them to win.
Yeah, absolutely. With Amplitude, our business is product analytics. And so, you know, and everything around it in our digital optimization system. And so, you know, we have no choice but to create the best product possible. So we had noticed a number of things that, you know, Google Analytics and a lot of the MarTech ecosystem were behind on. One was just the entire data model was not the right data model for understanding products. They had really focused on page views and focus on a world where your digital experience was all about marketing. But what we saw was that what people cared about was measuring the digital experience as it was a product. And so in a world where digital experience is the product, it's really about your users and how are they using, how are they navigating the different features and functionalities you have in your product, as opposed to, okay, who's hitting my landing page? And so, you know, one, that the data model was broken. And then the other big thing that we saw was that the ability to really dive deeply into understanding that user journey was really limited. You know, they had a bunch of reports that would work out of the box, but as soon as you tried to get to any sort of depth on it, you know, you really hit up against a wall. You know, so if you wanted to ask questions like, what did someone do right before they churned? Or what are the most common flows someone will take in order to convert from the free product to the paid product? You wouldn't be able to get at these. And so we said, okay, we know how to build an infrastructure and a product that allows you to do that. Since then, we've come up with a metric that we use, we found that is most correlated with success on Amplitude, which is what we call the weekly learning user. And that is a user who has shared an insight with another person on the platform. So who has shared a chart or a dashboard with someone else. And we find that that's the strongest correlation to long-term success. And so it's really helped us optimize around, you know, getting a user first time on the product to that insight and then having them share that with others. And that's kind of the really key flow. Whereas, you know, you look at a lot of Google Analytics and the MarTech stack and they haven't figured that out. So that's allowed us to do really well as a company. To answer your second question, in terms of examples of companies that we helped, one of my favorite stories is the one of Calm. Essie, are you familiar with Calm?
Yes, of course. The meditation and wellness service, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they're one of the leading meditation products in the App Store. And their business, when they started out, they had really focused on just doing a series of guided meditations for you. And their big question as a company was, what's the thing that really drives long-term success in meditation? Is it a certain set of meditations? You know, what is it within the Calm application? And what they found was that there was actually a group of users that formed only 3% of their user base that were way more successful at forming a habit around meditation than anyone else and were way more successful long-term users. And what they found was what none of them expected, which was the group of users was those who had set a daily reminder to meditate. And it sounds so obvious, you know, okay, setting a daily reminder will help you form the best habit around your meditation, but their product team didn't realize it. And so they had buried that feature behind a bunch of settings menus in the back of the application. And so only a small percentage of their user base used it. After finding that insight with Amplitude, what they then did was they brought that ability to set a daily reminder around meditation to the front of the application. Instantly, the percentage of the user base that used that feature went from like 3% to more than 50% overnight. Their retention and engagement doubled as a result, and they became one of the most used apps in the App Store and were actually one of Apple's apps of the year in 2017. And so just the key for them, you know, so just this rocket ship growth from that insight on Amplitude. And the key for them was really realizing that a core part of their product market fit was not just guiding you through the meditation. A core part of Calm's product market fit was actually reminding you to meditate at the right time. And so it was kind of this like realization of like, okay, here's where users are getting value in the application. And that being driven from a data and having a point of view. So that was a really awesome story where we were able to help them get a massive outsized success as a company through better understanding what their users were doing in the product.
I love that. And you know, the common thread from those two stories is really this keyword you use, right? Value. When your Amplitude customers are sharing or learning, it means they're seeing a lot of value in it. When the Calm users are getting reminders to, you know, take their wellness seriously, they have obviously some successes. So that shift from the marketing view of the world to a product view of the world is really about delivering value, right? Like making your customers have skin in the game and get more out of it. I'm going to switch now to, again, the view from today. You mentioned how Eric was super helpful to you in the early days. Now you have different kinds of investors and obviously a different relationship with them. Share with us how your relationship has evolved and what you value in your investors today.
Yeah, it definitely has changed. I'd say in the early days, you know, there was not much of a company. There was a very early product with some slight product market fit, and that was it. There was no brand, no sales team, no you know, awareness, no organization. And so, you know, we're really limited. And so it's just about getting stuff off the ground and finding people who are willing to do the hard work to help you get the train going. Now it's like, there's the company has a ton of momentum behind itself already. And it's really about how do we capture the full opportunity of that. In terms of investors, you know, I think each investor is now a lot more, you know, it's less of a generalist and more specialized in help. And so the company's surface area is a lot bigger, you know, than it was before. You know, we now have multiple products. We now are acquiring companies. We now have a brand out there. We now, you know, communicate with the press. You know, we now have customers and offices in, you know, all across the globe, you know, from France to the UK to Singapore to Japan. You know, there's a lot more breadth to Amplitude. And so the way you work with investors more now these days is you're kind of having them focus on a specific area of the business or specific problem that you're getting help with. And so, you know, GIC, the folks in Singapore, you know, they've been phenomenal about helping us get in touch with a lot of the great companies that are in Singapore and Southeast Asia. You know, we have, you know, investors who have been helpful with Japan. We have investors who are helpful with looking for particular types of talent like data scientists or marketers. And so the help you get is more kind of specialized. The other piece of it is that, like, you know, you have an organization that's kind of whose job it is to do this. And so, you know, you don't leverage, it's not like you leverage all the investors quite as much as you might in the early days. And so that changes as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so now I want to look at the future. And in this, you know, age of product with more digital transformations across, in fact, pretty much every segment of the economy, there's a new member that's entering the C-suite, and that's the chief product officer. And you and I were talking earlier about the arrival of the chief marketing officer about a decade ago with digital marketing, where, just like you were saying, right, it's like taking a quantitative approach to marketing. Well, now we're taking a quantitative approach to product. So maybe you can share with us how you see the role of the chief product officer take shape, what are going to be the KPI for success, and then how you think about that across multiple industries, not just technology.
The chief product officer is the new leader of these businesses, you know, full stop. You are not, what's happening in pretty much every company out there is a lot of these companies are shrinking, and the one bright spot is the digital product. And so the chief product officer becomes the area where the business is growing and the place where you need to invest if you're the CEO in order to make your business successful, because all the offline stuff is it's not growing anymore. And the one place that is, you know, growing like a hockey stick is the digital product. And so the chief product officer has become so important in a way it never was before. I think people used to view digital as just, okay, this is another channel for my efforts, right? You know, I might have my sales force, I might have, you know, my marketing campaigns, you know, I might acquire customers on the phone, and like, okay, yeah, we'll have an online presence as well. Now what's happening is all of the other stuff is going away and all moving to online. And so that's what makes the chief product officer so incredibly important. I think in terms of tech versus non-tech, within tech, these companies have always understood that, that product is the place that your business is growing. And so they've always invested from day one into this product leader. What's been really interesting is to see how non-tech is responding to it. The way I think, historically, I think a lot of these companies have had digital roll up to the marketing team, but increasingly what you're seeing is them breaking them out into their own teams. So you might have a GM of online or GM of digital, or, you know, maybe in some companies, the product and marketing orgs are actually merging and becoming one organization because it's all about just the customer experience end to end. And so you're seeing, you know, chief customer officers as well, or chief customer experience officers. In non-tech, the thing that these are called can vary quite a bit, but everyone is on the same page that product is the digital product is the thing that is the growth area of the business, and where it is that that you need to make an investment in. And so, you know, that's where these, you know, executives are getting a seat at the table for the first time.
Yeah. And, you know, when I look at the MarTech stack, right, the marketing tools, there's about 10,000 of them. In PropTech today, there's about 2,000. So there's a huge amount of room for growth. And just a few years ago, you know, Amplitude was one of like a couple hundred of these tools. So the chief product officer, I think, will have a massive set of not just responsibilities across the enterprise, but also budget responsibility, decision making. So there's just so much growth for them. It's interesting to see how they're, you know, getting to establish their credibility between the chief marketing officer, the CIO, the CTO. How do you see those relationships play out when you're working with your customers?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one. I don't know the answer to the question. I think just to caveat that, but I'll give kind of a few examples of what I have seen. I think historically, a lot of the stuff has rolled up to the CIO, and that's been viewed as a back office function. Hey, you know, if you want to implement something, you know, you need to go to the CIO to do that, and you know, they'll go ahead and make a decision based on how many seats and all of that you have. Increasingly, what's happening though is instead of going up to the CIO, you actually get this happening in the line of business, whether it's the GM or whether it's the chief product officer, the chief marketing officer just going off and saying, hey, I need to go drive this initiative. And instead of having it centralized under a central team, let me go and just do it myself. Let me give you an example of this. So Atlassian is really interesting. You know, they're very famous for being a no sales company. You know, they're all about, you know, product and product-led growth. So they had actually a central data science and business analytics team rolled up to a CIO, but you know, the equivalent person. And they had centralized all of the data and insights for the product under these teams. And what was happening was that the line of business users, so the people building the product, whether that's the PMs, the engineers, the designers, just could not get responses from that central team fast enough. And so the central team said, okay, well, we need to bring in something to solve this. So let's bring in Amplitude. And so now we started working with that business back a few years ago in 2016 with their mobile team, and have since expanded across the entire business, and now form a core part of their no sales rep, you know, growth strategy. And we have folks across the business, whether it's product management, engineering, design, even the central data science team, all using us. And so I think what you're seeing is tools go from siloed within the CIO, where the CIO has the control, to distributed. It's kind of an extension of, you know, Salesforce had that very famous campaign that where they were saying, hey, you don't have to have any software, we run on the cloud, you can cut IT out of the loop. And we're seeing that kind of across the board, where a lot of that stuff is, you know, even the central teams are advocating for more decentralization and, end users directly doing it, you know, from a product team or from the line of business.
That's really exciting. So a couple of lightning questions for you.
Lightning round.
Lightning rounds to wrap this up. If you took a magic wand and had a few predictions about the future, and you can pick your horizon, you can pick 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, what do you see and what are your predictions?
Oof. I normally think about this in the context of Amplitude. So in the future—
That's fine.
There's going to be a giant, right? So we as consumers are interacting with these digital products all the time. We're giving them so much data, whether we're using a browser or Zoom or our phone, you know, we're just interacting with them a ton. And to date, the software doesn't really respond back in a smart way. It just, you know, it's pre-programmed to do one thing. But if you think of the richness of that interaction data, there's so much data on me as a person and what I care about and what I want. The end state is, you're going to take all that data in, you're going to process it, and then you're going to be able to predict what it is I as a consumer wants. and read my mind before I know I want the thing, whether that's to, you know, do a meditation, whether that's to, you know, call an Uber, whether that's to, you know, send an email. The software can actually become a lot smarter in responding and knowing what I want before I even decide I want it, or tell the software to do it. And there's going to be a brain that powers all that stuff. And, you know, my goal is to set that up to be Amplitude, you know, to help make software respond to us as end users and be much more approachable based on what we've done. Software today is incredibly frustrating to use. You know, you have to learn so much technically about how to interact with it. You know, I always think about how can I make it easy for my parents or grandparents to figure it out. I think in the future, a lot of that frustration will go away because the software becomes smart and adapts to us as people. And so, you know, in some ways we almost, you know, it becomes an extension of our brains and ourselves, and, you know, we merge with it.
Yes. It's almost like more data means more personalization. And you were saying, you know, no software, it's like no more product, no, like invisible.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Love it. Okay. So next question, what makes a great VC investor?
Picking really great companies and helping them succeed. That's pretty much it. You know, if you can do that, you can succeed. I will say the ones I like really have those qualities I outlined at the start. So, you know, those three qualities: one, do they empathize deeply with the entrepreneur? Two, are they going to work hard? And then three, do they know what they know and know what they don't know? And, you know, that combination is really rare. And so, you know, as I'm looking for investors, that's what I'm top of mind, you know, for myself. And that's what I'd recommend, you know, other folks look for when they're adding someone to their board as well.
Awesome. What advice do you have for our audience of investors and innovators?
The key thing I'd say is, it's cliche, but it's so important, and people don't really hear it when the advice is given, which is you need to stick at it for a long time. If you're willing to stick at something for a very long period of time, the compounding that happens is just crazy. When we first started Amplitude, we saw a lot of other companies that had done Y Combinator with us that would quit early. You know, after 6 months of no success or a year of no success, they'd quit. And my realization was just, hey, if you stick at it long enough, you can outlast the competition and everyone else and kind of compound those gains. And so here I am 10 years later, still having the same mindset. A lot of, you know, even after 10 years, a lot of founder CEOs decide to leave the businesses because it is really intense and it is really tiring and it really does get to you. But if you're able to figure out how to set up your life in a way where you can keep that compounding going, you can end up in a very special place and just find, you know, we never imagined we get anywhere close to where we are today.
That's great advice. Spencer, last question for you. You're one of the smartest people I know. What are the things, the books, podcasts, blogs that inspire you and keep you sharp?
I've been reading, it's funny, it sounds geeky to say, but I've been just reading the S1s of other companies going public and just really understanding how they view the world. Just really, there's so much to learn in that from others. In terms of specific books, I'll give two. One is this book called Talent is Overrated that I read when I was 21 that really was tremendously influential on my thinking in terms of how I approached building a business and making myself the best version of myself I could be. And its thesis was what I just said, which is, you know, if you're willing to dedicate sufficiently long time, you can, you know, talent really doesn't matter. You can outlast anyone. The other book I'll give a shout out for is Five Dysfunctions of a Team. You know, that has formed the core. I was new as a manager when starting Amplitude and new as team builder. And that book, you know, there's a lot of business books that have all sorts of frameworks. But that book is a really, you know, simple, quick read and gave, you know, sets the standard for a lot of how I think about what a great team looks like and what I expect out of the teams that I work with today.
Awesome. Spencer, thank you so much. I learned a lot, really enjoyed the conversation. Any final word, any place you want us to go to?
Yeah. I mean, first, SC, it's been fantastic to have you as a supporter and investor in us through Mighty Capital. You know, you really, I credit to you, you foresaw a lot of what was going to happen with the product-led world way before anyone else. So to anyone listening, if you're considering raising money, you should definitely talk to SC. I'd say a lot of people think, you know, hey, you know, is there really an opportunity for me to build a business and to create something successful? And I'll say, as long as you're willing to put in many, many years into it, you can absolutely find success no matter kind of who you are, where you're starting from. And so there's never been a better time to start a business now, particularly, you know, you mentioned at the start of this podcast that, you know, there's been 7 years of digital transformation in one. And so everything is going online. All the old economy and old business models are being torn down and having to be rebuilt for the digital world. And, you know, so there's so much, there's more opportunity now than there has ever been in the past.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Spencer.
Awesome. Thanks, SC.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.